What's up, fools? This is the QTR Podcast. Today's December 17th, 2019. This podcast today and all my podcasts are brought to you by my patrons. Patrons are people that sign up and donate a monthly recurring sum through Patreon to help support the podcast. I'm going to shout some of those people out. Then I'm going to tell you that there's a two-drink minimum. Then I'm going to tell you that I'm not giving you financial or life advice and that you shouldn't listen to anything that I say. And then we're going to get the damn show on the road. First and foremost, I want to shout out my friends over at thetraderspath.com. The Traders Path is an investing service that's created for day traders that is going to offer you tools. It's going to offer you education. It's going to offer you a group of traders that know what they're doing to hang out with, follow with, chat with. They're going to provide you with live streams and daily watch lists, investor education. They trade in green markets. They trade in red markets. They trade options. They trade equities. And it's just a nice community. If you're a day trader, it's always cool to be a part of these communities because a lot of ideas float around. You can learn things and you're not just sitting at your desk all day hanging out by yourself. There's a little bit of companionship and camaraderie. The guy, Pete, that runs the Trader's Path, I've talked to extensively. He's a fantastic guy. He started his service because he was tired of the bullshit of all of the regular corporate services where basically they're just trying to take your money and then front run you on trades. We know there's some assholes out there in the trading world. Pete is not one of them, so check out Pete's endeavor over at thetraderspath.com. Link is in the podcast description. This podcast also brought to you by my friends at the Sanglucci Steam Room. Sanglucci and his brother Charlie Bathgate are two of the OGs when it comes to tracking options flow and money in the options market. Why is that important? It's important because the options market is illiquid, and when you see big money come into the options market, it can oftentimes foreshadow and telegraph moves that are going to happen in the equities market. It is a strategy that's become immensely popular over the last 4 or 5 years. Sanglucci and Charlie, along with Wall Street Jesus, are a couple of the guys that originated this, at least from when I started trading. I've known these guys for 6, 7, maybe even 8 years now. They're high quality guys. I consider them good friends of mine. And they've been successful. So their strategies work and they are proof that it works. In addition to offering access to their chat room where they're going to review options activity on live as it happens on a daily basis, they are also offering their master course in investor education, which is going to teach you things like market psychology and how to read the tape on a daily basis and follow momentum. Also, they're offering the 3LT playbook, which is a simple version that anybody can get down with of the three rules that Lucci used to make himself successful. I was talking to him the other day. We've both made a ton of mistakes in our investing careers, but ultimately, Lucci wound up on top. So what did he learn from doing that? He's going to teach you those three things in the 3LT playbook. That is all in the podcast description as well. The links are right there. Check out my friends over at Sanglucci. This podcast also brought to you by my friends at Rumorhound. Rumorhound.ai is the home of a very innovative artificial intelligence-based tool that many day traders may find worthwhile in checking out. It is a proprietary artificial intelligence-based algorithm that identifies numerous variables as they relate to mergers and acquisition rumors that happen on a daily basis. If you're a trader, you see M&A rumors every day. They come across major news networks like CNBC. They also show up in chat rooms and on Twitter and in less reputable places. Not that the mainstream media is reputable anyways, but that's another story. Rumorhound takes a look at the rumors as they come out. It puts them through their proprietary algorithm. It looks at all different metrics, things like whether or not the company has the financial viability, what the credibility of the sourcing is, and a bunch of other proprietary metrics to spit you out an easy to check out and an easy to read recommendation as to a rumor and whether or not it's something you may want to pay attention to, which as an investor can be lucrative if it works out, or maybe one you just want to let fly and not waste your money or waste your time on. So check out my friends at Rumorhound.ai. They have been supporters of the podcast for a long ass time, and I really appreciate those guys. Also, some of my patrons I want to shout out, and then we're going to get this show on the road. My friends over at Corvus Gold have been longtime patrons. I appreciate you. My brother Monero, my friend Jay Mintzmeyer, Russ Valenti, Nicholas Parks, Nathan Michaud over at Investors Live and Investors Underground, whatever the thing is called. Sorry, Nate. I love you. And Traders for a Cause, Chris Bede, Chris Boas, Ken R., Crichton Titus, my brother. Thank you for checking in. just today, man. I really appreciate that shit. I know I sent you an email. Ken and Mr. J.K. Cunningham, some of the other people that have been with this podcast as patrons for a while, making awesome interviews like today's interview happened. My friend Dale Short, Scott Corsi, and Elliot Bloch. Thank you, my friend. John Pollard is still with me, which I really appreciate. And going way back, guys like Michael Embley, excuse me, Kenneth Veland, and Craig Gordon, guys that have been with me, man, for like over a year now. We just passed 2 million total listens on the podcast. So it's because of your support, guys, that we've been able to do this. And I appreciate that shit very much. So thank you, guys. All right. Folks, I always recommend a 2-drink minimum for this podcast. And I want to remind you, I am not a registered financial advisor, and I hold no licenses, no registrations. I can barely keep my own life together, folks. So this podcast is not any kind of advice that you should follow at all. Do your research elsewhere. Figure out your life elsewhere. We're libertarians here for the most part, folks. Do whatever makes you happy, but if things go terribly, don't blame it on us, all right? That's it. All right, today I am very honored to welcome Jocko Willink to the podcast. For those of you that may not know Jocko, he is an American retired United States Navy SEAL. He has his own podcast called the Jocko Podcast. He is a New York Times best-selling author as well. He received the Silver Star and the Bronze Star for his service in the Iraq War and was commander of SEAL Team 3's Task Unit Bruiser during the Battle of Ramadi. I have heard some incredible stories that Jocko has told on other podcasts like the Joe Rogan podcast, like on his own podcast, discussing his service and his time serving the country. He co-authored the one book you may know him from, Extreme Ownership and the Dichotomy of Leadership. He co-founded his own management consulting firm called Echelon Front, and he hosts, again, his own weekly podcast. Mr. Willink, thank you very much for joining me, my friend.
Thanks for having me on, Chris. Appreciate it.
Yeah, you know, first and foremost, just on behalf of my listeners and myself, and certainly my Uncle Blackie, who's father was a Marine. You know, we all kind of wanted to thank you right up front for your service to the country. We're a grateful nation and very appreciative of that. I wanted to just say that up front.
Well, thank you. It was an absolute honor for me to be able to serve. So, no factor.
So, Jocko, I mean, here's what I was kind of hoping we could touch on to start with. A lot of my listeners have come in kind of through the financial back door and may not be familiar with you or with your history, with your books or anything. You know, I've watched your TED Talks. I've seen a number of your podcasts. So I was hoping up front, and forgive me if this is a bit repetitive for you, if you could kind of give my listeners a lowdown on what the concept of extreme ownership means and why, you know, this book that you wrote, I think in 2015, just wound up, why you think it wound up taking off as well as it did. You know, does it say something about the country and where we're at? Does it say something about, you know, this generation? Just if you could go into that a little bit and just explain that concept to start and we can go from there, that'd be great.
Well, the concept of extreme ownership is basically means that I'm not going to make any excuses. I'm not going to blame anyone or anything else when something goes wrong. I'm going to take ownership of problems and get those problems solved. That's what the idea of extreme ownership is. That's the name of the first book that I wrote with my brother, Leif Babin, who I served with in the Battle of Ramadi, and he was in Task Unit Bruiser with me as one of the two platoon commanders. There were two platoons in Task Unit Bruiser, and he was the commander of Charlie Platoon. And the concept is that straightforward. Look, I'm not going to blame anyone else. I'm not going to make any excuses. I'm going to get problems solved. And that idea of extreme ownership, that's only, I mean, that's the first chapter of the book. Obviously, it's the foundation of what we talk about. But, I mean, from a leadership perspective, but, you know, I think the reason that the book has done well is not just because of that chapter, but because of the entire book and talking about the laws of combat, the principles of leadership that we used in combat to achieve victory on the battlefield. And now people have used it in every asset and aspect of life to be successful. So I think that's why I've done well. It's pretty straightforward. It's pretty simple, and it works.
Do you feel like the, you know, from a bird's eye view, from a bird's eye perspective, when you look at the nation as a whole, do you feel as though we're due for, you know, to kind of re-up this concept of owning our mistakes and really just personal responsibility in general? I mean, what direction do you see the nation going in general?
Well, one of the things that I have that gives me a very good perspective is I travel around the country and really around the world, but mostly around America, working with all different types of companies, from manufacturing companies to power companies, energy companies, financial companies, just really anything that you could imagine, automotive industry, construction industry. And I work with people all the time and work with people at every level in the chain of command. And so what I see is a bunch of Americans that are out there working hard that do absolutely take ownership and make things happen in their world. And when something goes wrong, they get the problem solved. And I think that's the vast majority of Americans. And I think that's another reason why the book did well, is people, we kind of said what people already thought and what people knew worked. And when we said it, it allowed them to kind of codify that mindset. So that's what I see throughout America all the time on a daily basis. Would I tell you that there's a small portion of America that wants to blame other people and has more of a victim type mentality? Sure, you can see a lot of that as well, but I think that's sort of fringe elements. I don't think that's the iron workers out there. I don't think that's the police and firefighters. I don't think that's the manufacturing people. I don't think it's the majority of America at all. I think it's a small fraction of people that happen to be loud.
Right. And so when you look at the political landscape going forward, you know, one of the things that I like about you is you don't really, at least from what I've heard in your podcast and your interviews, I mean, you don't identify one way or another politically. You know, the issues and the stances that you take kind of run the gamut. And a lot of them, you know, to me sound as though they've been whittled away just from common sense. And certainly I watched your podcast that you recently did with Tulsi Gabbard, and, you know, you guys took the time to talk about how you guys can have civil discourse with one another despite the fact that you disagree on issues. I mean, do you feel like that's something that could potentially lead the nation in the wrong direction if we're unable to talk about those differences the way that you guys did, just sitting down talking to each other as friends? You know, I just don't see that a lot in the political discourse. Do you think that could be detrimental going forward?
Well, it's definitely detrimental to cast yourself in a position where you have no room to maneuver. And you learn that as a leader anytime, and I shouldn't say anytime, most of the time as a leader, if you should look at issues with an open mind and see what's going to be best for the team. Now, there are some issues, obviously, that as a leader, as a person, you should have certain principles that you don't really deviate from, and that's fine, but those should be few and far between, because everything else, you know, you've got to look at what's going to be best for the people around you and not just for yourself. So yeah, sitting down with Joe Rogan and Tulsi Gabbard, I can have a normal conversation with them, even though I might not agree with everything that Joe or Tulsi might believe. And that's fine, because I'd like to hear other people's viewpoints, see what they're thinking, see where I could be wrong, and then see where possibly I could convince them maybe of a different frame of mind for them. So if all I do is shut someone out or yell at them or call them stupid, well, they're never going to listen to me. So I've just ruined my position because I can't change them. Whereas if I open my mind, listen to what people have to say, take in what they have to say and actually process it, and then see what things look like from their perspective, and then try and shed some light on my perspective for them, there's a much better chance that I can convince them that perhaps they could see some issue in a different light.
Why do you think it's so hard for some people to kind of take that raw, you know, emotion out of the issues, whatever issue it is that they're debating or they're trying to figure out, you know, their position on, or you know, just have some type of Socratic dialogue with somebody about it. Why do you think it's so difficult for people to separate emotion from the issues? And I guess, do you have any tools for, I don't want to say being more of a pragmatist when it comes to those things, but being able to effectively, you know, communicate about those issues without flying off the handle, right? Which we both know is not going to yield any results.
Yeah, I think really you just have to keep your ego in check and make sure that you're not letting your ego get wrapped around something that you might believe at a certain time. And I think when you let your ego get involved and someone else's ego gets involved, you can't really carry on a good conversation anymore, because it's not about what the right answer to the issue is. The debate turns into I'm right versus I'm right and you're wrong, and that's the only thing I'm willing to accept, which is generally not going to work out well. You're not going to have a really good conversation. So I just try and listen to what people have to say, see things from their perspective, and then try and show them my perspective, and hopefully that brings them around.
How do you think you wound up in the position of being able to do that, of being able to separate your ideas from your ego so effectively and to communicate your ideas so effectively?
Well, spending many years in the military in a leadership position where I had to make decisions that were in pretty dynamic situations, oftentimes with unclear intelligence, oftentimes with changing environments and changing variables that you can't really know 100%. And any time you as a leader in a military, dynamic military situation say, hey, I know this 100%, it's almost guaranteed to come back and bite you. So I had to learn to step back, not let my emotions get involved, try and assess everything that I could understand and recognize that there were some gaps in my knowledge and be okay with that and be okay with still moving forward, making a decision, but keeping my mind open enough that if something changed, I could change that. I could change my mind as well.
So one of the dovetails I wanted to kind of take us on first, because I do talk a lot about the financial world, and a lot of my listeners come from come from a financial outlet one way or another. They found me through the financial world one way or another. Was I wanted to kind of ask you, I mean, this is one thing I've never really heard you speak about, or maybe you have and I've missed it, but you know, how you can kind of take this concept of extreme ownership and kind of transfer it over to personally how people manage their financial lives. One of the things that I advocate for on this show, and you know, one of the things we talk about all the time is personal responsibility. So when we talk about issues like student debt relief, for instance, where you know you have an entire generation now that's saddled with over $1 trillion in student debt, and the ideas for offering relief to them range from, you know, what I believe are pragmatic solutions all the way to just canceling out people's obligations and giving them a fresh start, which some people would argue creates a moral hazard. I'd be interested kind of on your take, you know, personally, how does that concept of extreme ownership transfer over to how you personally manage your finances, how you, you know, what you communicate with these business leaders that you talk to on a daily basis when you're giving these speeches?
Well, from a financial management perspective, I wrote another book called The Discipline Equals Freedom Field Manual, and it talks about the fact that in life, if you have discipline, you will end up with more freedom, and that applies to every aspect of your life, including your financial existence. So if you want to have financial freedom, which is a normal thing that people want, I would say very broadly, people want to have financial freedom. And if you want financial freedom, then what you have to have is financial discipline. And what that means is that you work hard, you save your money, you don't waste your money, you invest your money properly, and you don't spend your money on things that you don't need. And if you have that kind of financial discipline, in the long term, you will end up with financial freedom. So from a perspective of how to live your life, well, live your life within your means, spend less than you earn, make smart long-term investments, and you'll end up in a good spot. You know, as far as I mean, I don't know if you brought up the college debt thing. I mean, that just doesn't seem like a very good investment these days to spend a ton of money on college, where the jobs that you get coming out of college aren't necessarily great high-paying jobs depending on what you get your degree in. So that's an investment that you need to think about. And I think that ego gets involved there as well, where people want to go to a good school with a good reputation, and they don't really care what they get their degree in until they graduate and realize that their degree is all but worthless. And one of the only places that perhaps their degree has some worth is actually inside academia in the first place. So they end up in kind of a incestual life of just living and propagating the academic world. And I think that can be somewhat problematic. And I think that's sort of has led to where we're at. It's been a years and years worth of academic inflation. I mean, even me, when I was a kid, not everyone graduated high school, and it wasn't necessarily a bad thing. And there was plenty of kids that went to a technical high school where they learned to weld, or they learned how to install electrics in houses, or they learned carpentry. Both my parents worked at an agricultural school where people could learn how to farm. And those were high schools, and you didn't go to college after those high schools. You went and got a job, and you lived a normal life and did very well. And it was perfectly fine. No one looked down on you if you were a plumber or you were an electrician or you were a farmer. That was what you did, and it was an honorable profession. And in my mind, of course, it still is. But I think at some point, this academic inflation where it became, well, you know, you have to finish high school, and then you should take college prep classes in high school, and then you should go to college, and then you should go to 4 years of college, and then you should get your master's, and now if you don't get your doctorate, well, then you're just not on the right path. Well, anybody, you know, I went to college as an older person because I enlisted in the Navy right out of high school. And I was in college. I was at the University of San Diego. I'd been in the Navy for about 8 or 10 years at this point. And I was sitting in my class, and my professor, who was a doctorate, and I was an English major, and my professor was a doctor, had a PhD in English literature. And so I'm sitting in this class, and she had a tenured professor at the school, and San Diego is a very expensive place to live. And she was carrying on this conversation about how bad it was that she was the tenured professor at a great university, and she couldn't afford a house in San Diego. And I was sitting in the front row, which I always did in my classes, and I raised my hand, and she called on me with a scared look on her face, because I always kind of was tough to contend with in some of those classes. And I said, how long did you go to school for? And she said, I went to school for, I want to say she said 10 years. It was 8 or 10 years. And I said, well, how much did that cost? And, she said $250,000. And I said, well, hey, I enlisted in the Navy right out of high school, and I own not just one house in San Diego, but I own two. And so maybe the decisions that you made weren't great decisions from an economic perspective. And that's the kind of thing where, I enlisted in the Navy, and I saved money and bought houses. Instead of spending $250,000 on college, I had invested that money in real estate. So it just depends on where you're at. But I think that some of that educational inflation is problematic. And I think if nothing else good comes from it, I think that these massive debts that people owe will end up being a wake-up call, and people saying, I'm not going to go to college. I'm going to learn a trade, or I'm going to go into business for myself, or I'm just going to go get a job at a company. And I think companies are going to start hiring people that don't necessarily have a high academic degree from some prestigious college, because they realize that kids that are hard workers and put their minds to things, doesn't matter where they got their degree from.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with a lot of what you said. I want to discuss it a little bit further at length. Do you mind if I call you back on Skype? Because you've dropped out just a couple of times, and I have pretty good reception here, and I'm going through the Wi-Fi as well. So is it all right with you if I just pause this and I ring you right back on Skype? Okay, we're back. Thank you very much for your patience and working with me there, Jocko. I'm not sure where the issue was. But going back to what you said about student debt and, not everybody needing to go to college, it reminded me of coming out of high school and going to university. And I mean, I remember working and trying to scrounge together money as I was making my way through university. And meanwhile, everybody that I knew that had gone to like vocational school and had gone to learn a trade like you were talking about, you know, the ASC certified mechanics and the HVAC specialists, they were all opening up their own shops and all like doing very well right out of high school. And it took years, you know, 10, 15 years probably for me to get to a point where after getting my degree, you know, I had worked enough to catch up to where these guys were in terms of the money that they were making. And of course, as you said, you know, you had time on your side, right? Because you started grinding as soon as you got out of high school.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I joined the Navy, so it's there's a lot of benefits to that.
So do you think that there is an ethos now that, you know, everybody kind of feels as though they're entitled and have to go to college as soon as they come out of high school, that there's really, you know, that's it. Everybody's kind of on this track. And with the politicians talking about free college for everybody and kind of forcing everybody to go to college by virtue of other people paying for it, you know, do you think that that is pushing us in a direction we shouldn't be going in?
I definitely think it's a direction we shouldn't be going in. You know, I called it educational inflation because I think it's just inflated more and more since I was a kid. And, you know, when I was a kid, there was people that just, you know, they went to technical high schools. First of all, there's people that didn't even finish high school. And then there was people that went to technical high schools and they learned a trade and that was fine. And no one looked down on them for being an electrician or being a plumber. And then, you know, once I graduated high school, I joined the military. So that was another path to go on, which I would say at that time wasn't exactly viewed with high regard enlisting in the military. The path was, hey, go to college and that's sort of a pathway to a better life is what people thought. But then I think that that attitude grew more and more over time. And then it was, hey, not just go to college, not just get a 2-year degree, but get a 4-year degree. And then not just get a 4-year degree, but get a master's degree. And then not just get a master's degree, but get a PhD. And then not just get a PhD, but get a PhD from some school with a great reputation that costs a ton of money. And this educational inflation over time has put us into a situation where everyone thinks they need to go to college when the fact of the matter is, like I said, I work with companies all over the country. They don't need a bunch of people that have been to some Ivy League college. They need people that work hard, that are smart, that can figure things out, that can learn, that can lead. That's what companies need. So yeah, I think we've definitely gotten to a point where this whole educational idea is become much more expected of people, and I don't think it's necessary.
Do you think the people that are burdened with this student debt now, do you think they've been, you think, you know, the nation has kind of done them dirty and that they deserve some relief as it comes to this huge debt burden that people are now carrying out of college? I mean, do you feel like the right way to right the ship here is to offer relief to those that have taken out debt and offer them kind of, or maybe even just offer them tools to help repay the debt that they've taken out. Or you may think canceling the debt is a good idea. What do you think is right for that situation? Or do you feel as though, hey, you know, you've taken out this debt, it's your responsibility and that's a wrap?
Yeah, that certainly seems like the easy answer. Hey, this is your responsibility, that's a wrap. I mean, then that's kind of what it is. I definitely don't think the taxpayers should pay for it. Because I don't think that's even remotely close to something that should happen. If I was going to stick the bill with anyone, it would be with the universities themselves. It's you know, if you're going to let people come on this, if you're going to let them come to your school, then maybe you should either figure out how to confirm that they're going to be able to pay for it. That might be an idea, but you know, I look at it pretty straightforward. If you owe money, you pay it back.
The wild thing, Jocko, is that because the federal government has taken over student loans and because they want to make student loans widely accessible because of this altruistic notion that, hey, everybody has to go to college, what has happened is that the government is actually bearing the burden of the loans. The universities are getting paid. And in fact, you know, we talk a lot about free market capitalism on this show, and one of the big detriments that we talk about in the world of higher education is because the government is so eager to subsidize people to go to college, the colleges have less incentive to compete with one another. They have less incentive to lower their prices. They have less incentive to, make the staff per student ratio lower. It becomes a cash grab for the universities, unfortunately. So they're getting paid one way or the other already, which is part of the problem.
Well, that's definitely part of the problem. that's another good argument for the free market, because if the government wasn't subsidizing them, right, these situations wouldn't escalate so much because people would have to actually pay for them. So, yeah.
Do you consider yourself a capitalist?
Yeah.
Well, I know you've been like extraordinarily successful, but it's not something that, it doesn't come up too often in some of your other podcasts. So I think it's cool to kind of get it on the record and touch on it. I'd be interested in kind of your thoughts on this new political movement towards socialism and what you think of that.
Well, I don't think it's that new of a political movement. I mean, there was a bunch of socialists running around in the 1960s and early 70s, and they got older and they realized that they needed to pay for things. and I think the same thing will happen here. I don't think it's that big of a deal.
You don't see it as a threat?
No, not really. I mean, I guess the only time it could become a threat is if eventually people will vote for free stuff, and eventually if there's more people that vote for free stuff, they can have the majority, and that could end up being problematic. Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's kind of like the direction I was going in, because I think you've got a couple more years on me, but as far as I can remember in being involved and really following politics probably since my late teens, to me, I can't remember the left being as far left in terms of, coming right out and saying we're democratic socialists than they are now. But perhaps I'm mistaken. I mean, what's your perspective? I mean, do you feel as though...
Yeah, I'd say you're probably right. I think there's probably a little less, we've gotten a little further away from the Cold War. We've gotten a little further away from the collapse of the Berlin Wall and people really understanding how bad socialism and communism were. So I'm sure over time people forget that, and all of a sudden it seems like a cool t-shirt to wear. You get Che Guevara on your t-shirt, and that can up your hipster points a little bit, and people don't really know what it means. But so I'm sure that makes sense. I think that probably people are a little bit louder about it now simply because they don't really have any true understanding and knowledge. So, yeah, you could be right there.
I think one of the big problems, too, that I always talk about is that people are so content with what we have now, right? The people that are out advocating for socialism in the country now are enjoying all of the benefits of, decades of capitalism that we've had in the country. So when they wake up in their house and they get in their car and they go get their Starbucks and then go to a meeting to fight capitalism and advocate for socialism, they're living the benefits of capitalism, but they don't really see it on an everyday basis. They're not even thinking about it, and that to me is one of the more frightening things.
Yeah, well that certainly is a kind of ironic scenario that you're tweeting about capitalism's downfall on your iPhone, which is produced by, one of the most powerful companies in the world that makes a ton of money and makes incredible products and does all that because because they're capitalists. I mean, no doubt about it. So yeah, there's some irony in that. Hopefully people will wake up one day and realize that.
When you go and you speak to people about this, how do you try to, politely make that clear? How do you try to open their eyes to that?
Well, I talk about individual freedom and how that's important. The most important thing, as far as I'm concerned, and along with individual freedom comes individual responsibility. and you have to be responsible for what you do in your life. And that's what extreme ownership is, right? Taking ownership of mistakes that you've made and things that you've done wrong, and taking ownership of the actions that you perform now so that your future is good. So that's the way I talk about it. And again, I wouldn't say that I square off with people, but I try and talk to them in such a way that they actually listen to what I'm saying. So that they, I mean, I don't think it's a very hard stretch to say to someone, hey, I don't believe that the government is the solution to our problems. I mean, when you look at broad government programs, sure, there's sometimes where you need a little help from the government on certain things. But when you look at broad government programs, fundamentally, they're not going to be ideal. And they certainly can't produce things like an iPhone. So, you know, I always compare the government programs to the DMV. No offense to people that work at the DMV, but that's not exactly what you would call a highly efficient organization. The U.S. Postal Service. No, again, no offense to people that are postmen, but it is not exactly a highly efficient and profitable organization. It's heavily subsidized by the government. Whereas you look at one of the fully civilian sector postal delivery services like FedEx or DHL, I mean, those right. are really, really squared away organizations that can get you this package anywhere in the world in 24 hours. That's pretty awesome. And that's driven by individual people saying that they want to make more money, saying that they want to make something happen. And that's what you end up with. So again, I mean, I try not to attack people with these ideas, but I just try and have common sense conversations with people about them. And when you do that, I think people generally figure out that, yeah, this little system that we're working in, that we're living in, is pretty awesome.
It's funny that you use those two examples. I did a speech in May of 2018, and my speech was part of the point I was trying to get across is why I don't trust the government and why I don't trust the central banks. And two of the examples I gave, one was the Postal Service and the other one was the Department of Motor Vehicles. And you look at those. My father was a mailman, so I heard firsthand a lot of the stories about inefficiency. And of course, all you have to do is look at the Postal Service's financials to understand. You know, a company like Federal Express is a highly profitable entity, right? Where the stockholders have made, you know, obscene amounts of money over the years, and the company generates cash consistently. And the Postal Service, they just can't get their shit together from a financial perspective. And, you know, when you go to broach the subject with people, I've found that if you try to hit them head on, like you're talking about, and you say, like, ah, keep your hands off my tax money, you know, and they're like, there are people that are advocating for more taxes for social programs or whatever. One question I always ask that always seems to get some pause out of people is, do you think the government can spend your money better than you can? Right? I mean, because that's what it boils down to. Am I right?
Yeah, that's 100% right. And we all know the answer. Absolutely, without question.
Well, not all of us.
Yeah, well, it's. I think a lot of times people don't know the answer to that question only because they really just haven't seen enough of it. And, you know, maybe, you know, I worked inside the government. I worked inside the government for 20 years. I understand what a bureaucracy is. I understand how much money goes to waste. It's incredible. It's an incredible amount of money. And that's, you know, the military, the Postal Service, the DMV, you know, anytime you get into these big bureaucratic organizations where someone is going to get a paycheck regardless of what their output is,
right?
You're going to end up eventually, you roll that down and you know, expand that over an entire organization, you end up with something that's not very efficient. And it's unfortunate, but it's true. And that's just the reality. It's not that big of a deal. It's not like I'm you know, or you're saying some shockingly brilliant thing, or I'm saying some shockingly brilliant thing. It's like, hey, if you give someone, you know, the same amount of money, whether they do their job three times during the day or whether they do it 30, well, they're going to do it three times. And sure, you're going to get someone that's a do-gooder that's going to do it 32 times. Good. That's few and far between. The rest of the people are going to more than make up for their overproductivity with slack, and you'll end up with a very inefficient system. So, again, these are just pretty – this is just about understanding human nature. And if you understand, if you have a decent understanding of human nature, then you realize why these things, you know, why capitalism is what it is, why it's such an amazing environment to live in.
Yeah, I think you're dead on. And yet it is so difficult to open the eyes of people that advocate for things like what you're talking about, like politicians that advocate for guaranteed jobs, when they don't even realize the concept of a guaranteed job. When you remove the incentive, it becomes an oxymoron, right? It becomes pointless. There's no point. You know, if you're going to guarantee somebody a job, regardless of their productive output, right? We all know that capitalism is, you know, runs on productivity. So when you take productivity out of the equation and you're guaranteeing somebody the paycheck at the end of the day, you know, and these people are going to be surprised, Jocko, when the productivity isn't there, right?
Yeah, and there is something to be said for, you know, running a business. And I run and have run and currently run multiple businesses with many, many, many employees. I would say there's probably 100 people that work for me through the various companies that I own. And there's no doubt about it. You know, that's what things are tied to. And so I think it's good if people have actually run a business. And I think it's a very good experience to help people understand why capitalism is such a positive system, and where other systems fall short, you know, in the real world. Because idealistically, sure, let's give everyone everything free, right? That sounds great. And I think maybe when you're having conversations with people that have a very idealistic attitude, that's where it comes from. They want to do good, and God bless them for that. But the problem is the reality of it. And so I think that's where trying to help people sort of overcome that rift, or that gap between idealism and what would be nice and reality, and then where reality comes into play. And the best way to make things as ideal as possible is through using something that actually really works, which is, you know, having a company like FedEx that, yeah, they make their shareholders money, but guess what? They employ thousands and thousands and thousands of people that pay their mortgages and feed their families and pay for their cars, all based on this company and that company's drive. So it's and that's the best way. You know, I said this, you know, you mentioned the Tulsi interview with myself, Tulsi, and Joe Rogan, and you know, I just talked about, like, if you really want to help people, then help the economy, build businesses, make right. things, be productive. That's the best way to help, and it doesn't only apply to America. You know, even with if you want to help people in other countries, the best thing you can do is build the economy in America, which therefore builds the economy across the world, and that's what really solves problems. The government doesn't really solve problems. You know, what solves problems is the economy. And that includes, you know, I spent 20 years in the military, and the military is certainly a powerful force, but there's the most powerful force in the world is the economy and people's drive to build things for themselves and to make their world, their part of the world, better. And the more opportunities you give people to do that, the better off they're going to do.
Yeah. And yet somehow in this country, the idea of being a successful business person has been stigmatized for some reason. And the most recent example of this that I saw, and I don't know if you followed this at all, but was when Howard Schultz decided that he was going to explore running for president. Howard Schultz is the former CEO of Starbucks. Yep. And, you know, he was looking to run under a Democratic ticket, but he was looking to be a bit more of a centrist. And, you know, he was somebody that was raised, you know, from nothing, who just started working. You know, he went to go work for Starbucks in the 80s, and he started very low on the totem pole. And 40 years later, he's the CEO of the company. And not only did he work his way up, but while doing that, he managed whatever, tens of thousands of employees. He brought the company's stock to its all-time highs. He generated enormous sums of cash for the business. But not only that, Jocko, Starbucks really led the way in a lot of initiatives for offering benefits to their employees, paying college tuition. They were, I think they were one of the first ones to kind of raise the minimum wage. Now, Walmart and Amazon have followed suit. health benefits. Starbucks was always notorious for treating its employees quite well. Yet, when Howard Schultz, who is a self-made, I think he's a billionaire, but he's extraordinarily rich. He's a self-made billionaire, we'll call him. When he goes on a show like The View, he is he's just railed against, as if having success in the business world is some type of character flaw. What is that all about?
Once again, I think you're dealing with a fringe group of people that would rail against that. To me, people that I know and people that I talk to are totally for people being successful and doing well in their business and in their life. You know, is there some sense of jealousy from some person that is on a TV show, whatever TV show you're talking about, that is going to be jealous of some guy or trying to cut someone down? Or that's another thing, is to form bonds with people. A really easy way to form bonds with people is to find a common enemy. So you look at this guy, right, and you make him a common enemy because he's rich and successful, and therefore he must be evil. I don't know what to tell you about that. You know, there's plenty of people too, I think, on that are out there right now that look at business as being very positive. There's a whole movement of people that are entrepreneurs, and I'm talking young people they want to be entrepreneurs. I mean, there's whole groups of people that have, you know, entrepreneur websites and entrepreneur schools and entrepreneur podcasts. So I think it's out there. I think there's probably people that are against that, but there's plenty of people that recognize that doing good business is good business.
You think the shift in kind of content creation in general, from, you know, back in the day when we used to be able, really, if you wanted content 25 years ago, you had, you know, five or six newspapers and you had five or six main television stations before the internet. And now anybody can kind of be a content creator now, you know, even myself included. I started a podcast because the people I wanted to hear from weren't getting interviewed enough. Do you see that as a positive now that landscape has kind of opened up?
Yeah, it's awesome. I mean, it's crazy. You know, a primetime television show might have 1 million viewers, you know, maybe 2 million viewers. And I go into my converted closet with $1,000 worth of recording equipment and my podcast with one of my buddies, you know, that podcast gets 1 or 2 million downloads an episode. And so it's amazing. Yeah, I think it's fantastic. And I think that's one of the best things that's happened in a long time, is just this ability for anyone to get information out there to the world. And I mean, you know, it's a little bit misleading to say that anyone can create content. It's true that anyone can create content, but actually having people listening to it is different. And I heard a figure the other day that the average reader of a blog, when blogs were popular, the average amount of times that a blog was read of all blogs was one. I thought that was pretty funny. And I'm sure podcasts are getting close to that now. And you know, it's just the way it is, but it's an amazing opportunity to have this type of freedom to go out and make, you know, put information forward about things that you're interested in. And I certainly have enjoyed doing it. And it's been very, it's been a very cool path for me to go down.
Yeah. It's awesome to have your content out there. One of the things I wanted to ask you about that, and you'll have to forgive me, is I just saw today for the first time that you had this series called Way of the Warrior Kid, which is it looks like a series of three books that you've tailored just for children. And I was wondering if you could just tell me a little bit about that and kind of what inspired that and what those books are about.
Well, I have four kids. If you've ever tried to find a book for a kid that actually put out the values that you would want your kids to have, it's very, very difficult. And so I ended up writing my own books. Those three books are about a character named Mark, who's a young kid who is going through kind of the same problems that everyone goes through. and he can't do any pull-ups. He doesn't know how to swim. He doesn't know his times tables, and he is getting picked on by the school bully, and he's really sad about this. His last day of school, he comes home, and he remembers that his Uncle Jake is coming to stay with him for the summer, and his Uncle Jake was in the SEAL teams. And so when his Uncle Jake shows up, you know, he says, hey, what do you want to do tomorrow? You want to go play ball? You want to go for a swim? And the kid says, oh, I can't swim. Matter of fact, I can't do anything. I'm horrible. I'm not smart. I don't know my times tables. I'm getting picked on. So over the summer, Uncle Jake teaches the kid jujitsu, teaches the kid how to eat, teaches the kid how to work out, teaches the kid how to study, teaches the kid how to swim. And he does all this through hard work and discipline. So that's what the book is about. The next book, he actually, speaking of business and capitalism, he actually starts a business where he's mowing lawns to make money to buy a bike, and he rebuilds another bike to earn more money towards getting a new bike. It's all about just work ethic and discipline and hard work and applying yourself properly in the world. And the books have done fantastic, and I get great feedback from them all the time.
Talk to me about jiu-jitsu and children. You know, I started training a couple of years ago. Jiu-jitsu has completely changed my life. I was just reading an article yesterday that was in the New York Post about a young girl named Luna who was being picked on by the school bully who, just like your story, went and enrolled in jiu-jitsu and now is no longer having any problems. Talk to me about jiu-jitsu and children and why you would recommend jiu-jitsu for children.
Jiu-jitsu is, I believe, the best gift that you can give your children. It teaches kids truly how to defend themselves, where they can handle themselves in a fight situation, which is awesome. It also teaches them that there are situations that they are not going to be able to get out of, so it makes them smarter from that aspect as well. So they become more confident. It teaches them about humility. It teaches them about discipline and hard work. Not by saying this is discipline and not by saying you should work hard, but by actually forcing you to do it, by actually being humble, because you get humbled by people tapping you out. So jiu-jitsu is a fantastic thing for kids, and that's a huge part of the Warrior Kid books as well, is him learning jiu-jitsu so he can handle himself and not get picked on by this bully anymore. And hey, Chris, I've actually got another call kicking off here in 4 minutes.
No problem. I really appreciate you taking some time for me, Jocko, and hopefully we can get back after it maybe in the new year and talk about some other things.
Yeah, man, cool. You got this is my cell phone number you just hit me up on, so send me your cell phone number. That way, when you send me a text, I'll know who it is.
You got it, brother. Thank you so much for spending some time with me. I appreciate it.
Appreciate it, bro. We'll talk to you later.
All right. That was the one and only Jocko Willink. I appreciate him very much coming on, and I just had a million questions for him, so hopefully we get him back on and we can talk to him a little bit further. But look, I think this is a guy that gets it. I think from a common sense perspective, what he hits on when it comes to just life in general, leading your life. I mean, obviously he's an American hero, he's a patriot, he's one of the best leaders the country has probably ever seen, and with that comes these very common sense, practical kind of assessments of things like student debt, of things like how to carry yourself as a person. And I think Jocko has it nailed. I look forward to speaking to him again. And thank you guys so much for listening. I have a ton of other great podcasts booked. Actually, like a couple good ones before the holiday and then a couple great ones in January. So I will talk to you guys then. Peace.